approval process. And even this last week, I was happened to be talking with someone that came in to see me, and their whole firm was moving up to Southern Oregon because of this business about workers' compensation, and they are having a terrible time having the workers be able to find affordable housing, and given the whole entire situation, they've just elected to bail completely out of California. So this 40% is what a lot of folks are saying. That particular figure comes from special reports that are being compiled. And then an article here in the Sunday Sentinel, "Don't Worry About the Welfare State, It Is Here to Stay." And we have this by Robert Samuelson, who I think is the son of Paul Samuelson, who used to write a lot of economic textbooks, one of which I had to read about 30 years ago when I was going to school, and realize, looking back, how it managed to say so much without saying anything of too much import. Anyway, quite an article. It touches upon a lot of topics that we talk about here. And he frames it actually in a lot of the ways that the previous caller often talks about the welfare state, protecting people against the insecurities of the business cycle, the injustices of unfettered capitalism, so says Robert Samuelson. And he talks about a book written by Peter Lindert, "Growing Public Social Spending and Economic Growth Since the 18th Century." And basically, this person is saying that don't worry about the welfare state crippling economic progress. Relax. Everything is fine. High taxes and everything that goes along with the welfare state haven't really depressed economic growth, according to this person, Peter Lindert. And he goes on and talks about how soaking the rich is actually maybe a bit of a problem, because there's just not enough rich people to go around. So he kind of balances out with the liberal agenda on that. And then the article concludes with, "The welfare state will be resilient only if we make it so." Well, there's so many things that are left out of this article. Charles Adams wrote a great book called For Good and Evil, in which he talked about the level of taxation from the Egyptian times to modern times. And basically, the conclusion of the book is that good taxation builds peace and prosperity, whereas bad taxation can destroy a civilization. And this article totally ignores the effect of the Federal Reserve System upon the welfare system. And it also ignores the fact that there really hasn't been a really good example of a modern society that did not have a fiat currency. It almost goes without saying that if you have a fraudulent monetary system, you're going to need some kind of welfare system, or you're going to have riots on the street. Well, this is Tom Clooney. It's been quite enjoyable talking with you all. I enjoyed the phone calls here, and I hope we can do this again next Monday. I'm here every Monday evening from 7 to 8. And please, when you if you're in and about, feel free to call in and let your friends know about the show. We've got a couple great hours coming up here, so stay tuned. Thank you very much.
Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here on the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us Jock Mass from back in the Washington, D.C. area. He works for Roger Milliken Industries. And we're going to be talking about globalization. We're going to be talking about the planned program that is exporting our jobs to other countries. Do you realize that the Export-Import Bank guarantees corporations that transfer their manufacturing facilities to perhaps to communist China with a guarantee that if their plant is nationalized, they'll get back their money? I was told by a congressman they could even get back twice their money if they just invested over there. And we know over the overseas export financial institution, one of the think tanks, that's not the exact name, but it subsidizes corporations to move overseas. There are special tax breaks you get if you're a corporation, you move overseas, and especially don't bring your money back and invest it in America. We're doing everything we can to encourage the exporting of our jobs, of our factories, and of course, disseminating or redistributing the wealth of the middle class of the United States. Jock Nash, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Dr. Stan, it's my pleasure.
Why don't you give us just a little bit of background for our listeners who really don't know who you are. Who are you? What are you trying to accomplish? You talk on globalization, and what's wrong with free trade?
Well, the first of all, who I am, I'm an attorney. I've had that narrowing experience. I work for Roger Milliken. I work only on the trade issue. I represent him and his textile and chemical company in Washington. I've been doing that for 19 years. I've been to 50, 60 different countries on bilateral trade negotiations. I'm a student of the U.S. government and an observer on the trade issue, and we're fighting like the Dickens to try to wake up the oligarchs and the elites that are running this country and trading away our birthright and our jobs for fellow Americans. So,
well, are you suggesting then the people in charge really don't know what they're doing, or do you think that they perhaps have a different vision of what the world should be?
Well, I think that since the beginning of time, there's always been the pendulum would swing from who gets the value added when something is made? Does the person who makes it, or does the person who the capital, the financing of that project? And for some 20 odd years, it's been pegged over on the capital side, and the American worker has gotten a precious little out of the wonderful U.S. economy. Do I think it's by design? Absolutely. The folks on the other side are not stupid. The problem is that the American people have been supine and have let them do as they wish.
Well, of course, the thing is that they keep talking about free trade, and certainly we're all in favor of free enterprise, free trade. So what is basically wrong with this idea of free trade between nations, free trade between countries? And just hold that thought, because we're going to have to actually take a quick break here. And when we get back, I want you to address what's wrong with free trade, or is it possible that we're really not talking at all about free trade, that the American people are being intentionally and purposely misled? Well, Well, our guest this evening, Jacques Nash, who works for Roger Milliken and Company, an international textile manufacturer, but certainly Mr. Milliken has always been dedicated to preservation of our society and really treating his employees and treating the working man very fairly. So what's really wrong with this concept of free trade, or, as I mentioned, is this really free trade we're talking about?
Well, there's not anything wrong with free trade. It's merely a theory, and propounded by Adam Smith in 1776 when he wrote his book Wealth of Nations, and later Ricardo, one century later, when he brought the theory of comparative advantage, that each nation should make what it does best and trade the things that it does best with nations that do other things better. And that way that we're all enriched thereby. And the founding fathers of this great nation believed in interchange of commerce. But when they wrote the Constitution, they made sure that we would have free trade among the several states. In other words, among the states of the Union. But in Article 1, Section 8, they departed from that, and they said, oh, but Congress will regulate our commerce with foreign nations. So free trade with other countries is much different than free trade between, let's say, California and Oregon.
Well, now, Chris, wasn't the reason that the Founding Fathers put in this concept of tariffs and excise taxes is they wanted to protect our industries, they wanted to protect our people from unfair competition from abroad, and this was, what, we're talking about well over 220 or more years ago, so they could see at that time that if we took down all the tariff barriers, why our fledgling industries would be simply destroyed, wouldn't it?
Oh, absolutely, because we were merely a colony of the very relatively industrialized England and at the time, and even Abraham Lincoln put it very simply. He said, let me see, we need railroad ties. When we buy railroad ties from England, we send them money, we send them gold, and they send us railroad ties. At the end of the transaction, we have the railroad ties and they have the gold. But if we made the railroad ties ourselves, at the end of that transaction...
Hold that thought just one moment here. All right, fine. And first, our guest is Jacques Nash from Roger Milliken and Company, and he was saying that Abraham Lincoln had said, if we bought railway ties from Great Britain, we would give them gold, we'd end up the railway ties. If we made the railway ties here, and that was the rest of the quotation?
Yes, well, if we made the railroad ties here at the end of the transaction, we would have the gold and we would have the railroad ties. And so, in the second act of the first Congress, the first thing they did was they put tariffs on industrial goods, finished products, coming into this country, in order to grow our industrial base. And that held us in good stead for well over a century, growing this country into the greatest manufacturing nation on the history of the earth.
But of course, at one time we were the greatest lending nation in the world. In other words, we had more money lent to other countries. That, of course, is rapidly changing. Today, we are one of the greatest debtor nations in the world, simply because, we are simply buying things from overseas, and we don't have the money to do it. So we have a massive trade deficit. We're having to borrow money, about $1.7 billion every day from other countries just to keep our debt in line. Doesn't seem to me like we're doing as well as we were 100 years or so ago.
No, we are not. And because in the last, people don't read history, Dr. Stan, and sometimes if it hasn't happened in the last 25 years, for many Americans, it hasn't happened. But indeed, a little more than 25 years ago, we still believed that countries are made great not by what they consume, but by what they produce. And so we were very much into producing, not consuming, saving, not spending, so on and so forth. We have changed, and we have changed to the detriment not only of ourselves, but every future generation of Americans.
Posterity. Somebody said that, you know, you can't spend yourself into prosperity, and yet that would appear to be exactly what our leaders are trying to do. Spending money they don't have, borrowing it for future generations, and hoping they're not going to have to be around to pay the consequences.
Yes, Dr. Stan, you know, just the other day another government report came out saying that Americans had borrowed on their homes. They had taken out second mortgages or refinanced and taken almost $500 billion out of their home equity. They have taken an appreciating asset, the home, and spent that money on depreciating consumable items. You cannot do that.
You can't do it indefinitely. You can do it for a time, but eventually the day of reckoning comes, especially as we look down the road and we find that even Alan Greenspan is talking about the fact that Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, who actually control the majority of the housing loans in this country, he says they've created a tremendous bubble and something's got to be to restrain them, or there's going to be catastrophic results from this current housing bubble. And when the time comes when the house that you're living in is not worth anywhere near as much as what you owe on it, and you don't have a job to make the payment anyway, why, of course, I'm afraid many of our citizens are going to lose their homes. And, of course, then what happens?
Well, then that's when life becomes nasty, brutish, and short, because the debt bubble, the 40% of our fellow Americans pay off their credit cards each and every month. 60% do not. Of the 60% that do not, the average family of three has $18,000 of credit card debt. In other words, we are massively, massively in debt as individuals, as families, as an
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I'm Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.